Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, Liz Cheney is out, Elise Stefanik is in. On Wednesday, House GOP members voted to strip Representative Cheney of her leadership position in Congress. It was a move months in the making, as Cheney continued to criticize former President Trump and his lies about the 2020 election. Today, the Republican caucus replaced her with Trump loyalist Elise Stefanik, an appointment many see as the clearest signal yet of the former president's grip on the party. Norm Ornstein has been studying Congress for nearly five decades and has written extensively about the rise in partisanship in Washington. He joins me to talk about what this shakeup means for the state of the GOP and whether we might see a split in the party. Norm, this was the second attempt to remove Liz Cheney from her leadership position. Remind us of the first time earlier this year, what happened?
So the first time, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, where, of course, there was discontent because, in the first instance, Liz Cheney had voted for the article of impeachment in the House on the incitement to insurrection done by Donald Trump, one of 10 Republicans. And there they did a secret ballot vote where she prevailed by a pretty substantial margin. This was different this time around. And this time around, of course, the attempt to oust her from the leadership was led by Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, who in the interim, and it's important to look at this, on January 6th, we know that Kevin McCarthy, as these seditionists were assaulting the House chamber, called Donald Trump and pled with him to provide assistance. And we know from the statements made by Republican members who heard the conversation that Donald Trump's response was first to say that it was Antifa doing this, to which McCarthy said, no, these are your supporters. And we know that Trump then said, well, I guess they care more about the election than you do, Kevin, which was met with expletives, including the F word used against the president by Kevin McCarthy. This same Kevin McCarthy, a couple of weeks later, went down to Mar-a-Lago to kiss Donald Trump's ring and plead with him for support. First, apparently, he asked for Trump's mailing list for contributions, which Trump did not give him. But Kevin McCarthy basically then went all in with Trump, went down to Mar-a-Lago again just recently. And it was almost the decisive final step in turning the Republican Party into the Trump cult. And now Liz Cheney, because she has been continually outspoken about the fact that the election was fair, that the election was won comfortably, if not more so, by Joe Biden, has become persona non grata, shunned by what is now this cult.
What about the vote on Wednesday? That was not secret ballot.
It was not secret ballot. It was not a public vote. It was a voice vote. And it was basically an attempt to get past this without putting any member in a position of having to take a stand. And what it reflects is two things, I believe, Diane. The first is a level of cowardice that is rampant in the ranks of these members. You know, we've seen at least a couple of Republicans in the House, Adam Kinzinger, who's the most outspoken among them, saying that he doesn't think there is more than a handful who really truly believe that the election was stolen. My guess is it's more than a handful, but it's less by far than a majority. But they do not want to do anything that calls into question their fealty to Donald Trump. And it's not that Donald Trump himself has a hold over them so much as it is that he has a hold over their constituents. And there's a fear of crossing him. And what happens in a cult of being shunned. So that's certainly one part of it. I think the second part is they just wanted to rip this Band-Aid off and try and move on as if this has never happened. And what is so surprising, maybe not surprising isn't the right word. I'm not surprised by any of it anymore. What is so shocking is we see in the aftermath of this, the hearing in the House on January 6th, where every single Republican on the relevant investigative committee basically either tried to downplay what happened, or as we know, in something that is almost beyond belief, say that it was no different than a normal tour done in the Capitol. You know, one of the things I tweeted the other day is, you know, I don't recall 400 people being arrested on a tourist group coming to the Capitol before. So, sorry about that. My dog Henry is protecting our household.
Dogs are a part of our lives.
You know, what we've seen is Republicans, instead of being shocked and dismayed at terrorists run rampant, trying to kill them, trying to overturn an election but destroy the Capitol, going after their own vice president, whose life was threatened that day, now want to pretend it didn't happen at all. And it's shocking.
Where is that leadership coming from that says, let's march together and claim that it was nothing more than ordinary tourists visiting? Where is that guidance coming from?
I would put it right back directly on Kevin McCarthy to start with. But what we've also seen is that while Mitch McConnell, who's being vilified regularly by Donald Trump, who made a statement even as he made sure that Trump's impeachment by the House did not result in conviction by the Senate the second time around, still condemned Trump for inciting the violence, but says nothing now as we see these deniers move forward and dominate the party. Kevin McCarthy has basically determined that their best path to achieving a majority in the House is to line up behind Trump to convince as many Americans as they can that nothing serious happened on January 6th. And the frightening thing is that given what we just saw with the census and the redistribution of seats, the reapportionment, what we are going to see with partisan gerrymandering, what we're seeing in states from Iowa to Florida to Tennessee to Georgia and many, many more, Oklahoma, is a series of laws that don't just promote voter suppression, but that try to put in the hands of their own partisan Republican officials the ability to overturn the election results if they don't turn out the way that they want, that you can't discount the possibility that this strategy, such as it is, could work. And frankly, I can't think of a more difficult outcome or a bigger stain on the House of Representatives and our constitutional system than the idea of a Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
Well, here's the other question. What's happened to the recount in Arizona? Where does that stand?
This is not a recount so much as it is an audit. And we have to keep in mind that every major election official in Arizona, every time that they've been through a recount, reaffirming these results, and that what's happened now is that the legislators, the Republican majority in the Senate in Arizona, the state Senate, put in charge of this audit after they seized, probably illegally, all the ballots, which they should not have access to, a company that was all in on Trump's false claims about an election being stolen, and that they haven't allowed journalists in or anybody else to independently watch what they're doing, that they might very well be doctoring ballots, and that at least one of their members has said anonymously to some journalists that this is going to be a huge embarrassment on them. But it's a sign of where we're heading down the road. If they're doing this now, retrospectively trying to change the result of an election that not only has been independently verified and verified by election officials, but by judges, including Trump-appointed judges, imagine what happens with the next election. And we're in Soviet territory here now, and it's an extremely frightening thing. And it's why watching as Congress grapples with its attempts to try and at least take some control over federal elections to make sure that they are protected against chicanery, that this is a very high priority, but we have no assurance that any of it will happen.
I want to go back for one moment to Liz Cheney. Had there been a secret ballot, would the outcome have been different?
You know, I don't think it would have been different this time. And what we have to remember here is that while Liz Cheney is as conservative as almost any member of the Republican Party in the House, and her views are certainly more reflective of the consensus in that party than the woman who replaced her, Elise Stefanik, that two-thirds of the House Republicans after the insurrection that could have killed some of them, after that, that same day voted that the election had been stolen from Donald Trump. So their sentiment is there in public, but I think most of them wanted to move past this as quickly as they could. I don't think it will work. I think Liz Cheney now has a much higher profile than she would have otherwise. But I believe that the secret ballot results from the first time would have been reversed this time.
Let's talk about her replacement, Elise Stefanik. What do we know about her?
What we know about Elise Stefanik is that she emerged at a very young age, working in the Bush White House and otherwise, as an extremely smart, Harvard-educated moderate, and somebody who opposed Donald Trump in 2016, who was emerging at that time as a young, fresh face of moderates, who made a cynical determination around the time of the first impeachment of Donald Trump that her political future would be secured if she went all in as a Trumpist. And it was a dramatic reversal, not just in attitudes, but in approach. And what we've seen is her combative and bomb-throwing efforts during that impeachment process. What she has said and done since is almost breathtakingly cynical, but it's obviously paid off for her now. And we know that a lot of those Republicans who had associated with her and admired her when she was, in fact, a moderate, who don't believe that she believes what she's saying now, but who don't know for sure, are deeply disillusioned with what she has come to represent. And if we're looking at opportunism personified, it's Elise Stefanik. What's interesting here is that when she was first proposed by Kevin McCarthy as the replacement, a lot of the most conservative Republicans in the House, the Freedom Caucus members, were very unhappy because they'd seen her moderate side. And when I say moderate, I should note that it's not moderate by any objective definition of moderate. It's comparatively moderate, given a party that has moved dramatically to the right. And they did put up an alternative, Chip Roy of Texas, a very conservative man. But I think, you know, Stefanik prevailed in part because they didn't want to replace a woman with a man because of the optics, but also they didn't want to take on the leadership directly in that sense either and create what they would see as a further division. There's something else we need to point out here, Diane, and it's something that was done very effectively, I think, in an article that Jeff Greenfield has just written, that we refer often to this as a Republican civil war in the House, but it's not a civil war. A civil war implies that you have two substantial armies fighting each other in an internal battle. This is, as he put it, a purge. And what's happened is that systematically, we are seeing among elected Republicans a purge of the dissidents. And the dissidents in this case are not based on ideology, but based on how loyal they are to the leader of the cult. And they've won. This is now the Donald Trump Party, or at least the Trumpist Party. And I am absolutely convinced that when we get to a Republican presidential nomination in 2024, whether Donald Trump runs or not, the other candidates are almost all going to be running as younger, tougher, more ruthless versions of Donald Trump. And it's a sad reality.
There was a piece I read the other day, in some ways comparing Donald Trump to Sarah Palin after the election, after she had lost as a vice president, saying that in that first year, she made all kinds of money. She went out, did all kinds of speeches. She was on everybody's talk show, spouting her beliefs and suggesting, not saying, but suggesting that the same thing might happen to Trump. I gather you do not support that idea.
Well, with a caveat, and I would say even before we start on that, that I was in Minneapolis for the Republican convention in 2008, where Sarah Palin was greeted rapturously. And she was the forerunner of Donald Trump. She brought in this sort of know-nothing populism, nativist and worse, that captured a large part of the imagination of the Republican Party, and I think paved the road for Trump. Now, she made a lot of money. She also has descended into utter irrelevancy, partly through a very dysfunctional family. And one can imagine Trump having the same reality. I had not believed until recently that Trump was going to run again, that in fact, he was going to talk about running because he can pull in huge sums of money. And one of the great flaws in our campaign finance laws is that you can spend campaign money almost any way you want. So he could use it for his own lifestyle, but he may well be tempted to at least running again as he sees this fealty that people have towards him. But we have to offer a giant caveat here as well. We know now from a lot of speculation that Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is one of the likely contenders for a Republican nomination in 2024, has been laying the groundwork to deny extradition if and when Donald Trump is prosecuted in the state of New York. And it is very, very likely that Donald Trump is going to be prosecuted. The attorney general in New York, Letitia James, the prosecutor, the DA in New York City, Cyrus Vance Jr., have all moved forward with a lot of deep investigation into what is very likely to be charges of tax evasion and fraud against Trump. And they have every incentive to do that. And there's a very strong possibility that he'll be convicted. Now, one of the things we know that he is potentially culpable with is overvaluing his properties to get loans, mortgages, and then undervaluing the same properties to avoid taxes. Many of us remember Leona Helmsley, who was a hotelier in New York, who spent 18 months in prison for doing just that. So we have precedents here. And there's probably more than that. We know that the longtime Trump family accountant, Mr. Weisselberg, is now being squeezed by prosecutors, and he knows where all the bodies are buried here. So what happens if you have a Donald Trump who is tried and convicted in New York, where he can't travel to New York or probably travel outside of Florida to other states where governors and authorities might take him and extradite him to go to New York, running for president? Can you run for president by saying, I'm not leaving Florida? That's going to be an interesting dynamic here. My guess is he'll make all this money. He'll stay out of it as much as he possibly can. I still doubt that he'll run. But in a lot of ways, if we're looking at a set of candidacies that includes a Ron DeSantis, a Tom Cotton, a Josh Hawley, that's not any more comforting.
But wait a minute. Okay, so if New York, in its wisdom with these prosecutions, says that Donald Trump should be prosecuted and is prosecuted and is found guilty, whether he appears in New York or not, doesn't some law take over and say, the man is guilty, he's got to go to prison?
There is no law that says that he is unable to run for president as a convicted felon. And in fact, we have precedents at other levels. We've had figures in Massachusetts who've been able to do that, among
but
others.
But he can't run for president.
But he can't, no. And, presumably, if he tried to do this and somehow got elected, traveling to before an inauguration, he could be picked up. I mean, you know, we're in bizarre territory here, and we don't know where any of this leads. And yet, we know that he is in serious legal jeopardy. And we also know, among other things, that his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is now in very serious legal jeopardy. And it's entirely possible that if Giuliani is facing the possibility of a long prison sentence and no pardon here from Donald Trump, he might turn on Donald Trump. And he clearly has a lot of additional information about Trump's role with Russia, with Ukraine, and otherwise, that moves us into different territory of culpability.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Norman Ornstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Norman Ornstein. His most recent book is titled One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. There are some Republicans, certainly Liz Cheney among them, who see this as a moment of real crisis for the Republican Party. What is it that they are saying, and how effective is what they are saying to reach the people out there, the voters?
That's the critical question, or a very, very critical question. It's troubling. First of all, we know that the overwhelming majority of Republicans still stand by Donald Trump. We know that in March and April, at least, we've had credible surveys showing that between 60 and 78% of Republicans believe that Trump won the election. We know that Fox News, talk radio, and other outlets, the ones that they listen to, continue to parrot this set of falsehoods. You know, I watched Bret Baier on Fox interview Liz Cheney yesterday. And when she said Fox News has to stop repeating these falsehoods, Bret took great umbrage and interrupted her multiple times, but said, you know, we've never done that on my show. And my response is, Bret, I'd like to introduce you to Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and many others. So people continue to believe that. Now, the question for me is, what about those college-educated suburban Republican voters who were turned off by Trump enough in 2018 in the midterms that they gave the House of Representatives back to Democrats, who in 2020 tended to vote for Joe Biden, but went back to their tribal identity and voted Republican for other offices, which is why Democrats lost enough seats that the House became very close and didn't pick up any of those state legislative chambers that they needed to avoid partisan gerrymandering, and lost Senate seats that they might have won otherwise. Where will they be when the rubber meets the road? And that's a critical question for 2022. Will Liz Cheney, the Never Trumpers, and others be able to say, look at what's become of the Republican Party in the House and Senate now? Look at a Senate that is now dominated, a party in the Senate dominated by the Ron Johnsons and Rand Pauls of the world, anti-vaxxers and deniers of the pandemic, as well as promoting crazy falsehoods about the election. Look at the House of Representatives, where the top three leaders now are all in on falsehoods about Trump and the election, and try to deny that there was an attempted sedition, and would be perfectly comfortable with another one if it put them in power. Where will they go? And that may determine the future of our republic.
Would that perhaps lead to a split and the organization of a third party?
We know that a number of Republicans, including some very prominent ones, have talked about creating a third party. We may see that happen, but what we have to remember is that our political system is set up with its culture and its rules around a two-party system. Remember that all of the offices that we're talking about, the House, the Senate, and the House state legislatures, what we call first past the post. They're single member districts where there's one winner. Now, maybe that third party kind of candidacy would split the votes and make it harder for them to win, but you could just as easily imagine that those, just to pick the example, those suburban educated voters, instead of voting for Democrats, would vote for that third party and actually give the radicals a greater opportunity to win. So it's a dangerous process that we're facing right now. And it, you know, I have sympathy for a lot of people who don't feel comfortable as Democrats. Their philosophy is much more conservative, but basically believe in the Constitution and in institutions and in fundamental norms, and don't like corruption and don't feel like they have a home right now. And it's partly incumbent on Democrats to try and make them more comfortable and find a home, which is not an easy thing to do, given their own, you know, our parties have to juggle a lot of different interests. But we also have to make sure that it doesn't turn into a destructive force that actually creates more traction for the pernicious ones.
Given those concerns, how do you think our President Joe Biden is doing?
I think we have the right person in the right place at the right time as president, that we have a president who is not, much as the Republican leaders have tried, become the kind of flashpoint where they can turn all their ire against him. He has done as much as he can to try and be accommodating and open and be the president of all of us, his personality and his demeanor, while at the same time, he has managed to avoid deep schisms within his own party. And if you look at the level of accomplishments, what he's been able to do by executive action, what he was able to get in that massive rescue package, what he might well be able to get with this new infrastructure plus package, given that he has a 50-50 Senate and the slenderest of majorities in the House, is quite remarkable. Now, he's got big burdens ahead, and I'll come back to this. They need to at least get a Voting Rights Act through. That's not enough. given some of these new laws emerging in states.
Exactly.
But it would be a big step forward. You know, what the Shelby County decision did in the Supreme Court was to cut out this so-called preclearance provision that affected a limited number of states that had had a history of racial discrimination. It meant that before they could change their voting laws, they had to clear it with the Justice Department. That's gone now. The new draft John Lewis Voting Rights Act brings it back with a modest expansion of the jurisdictions. It's interesting. Joe Manchin the other day made a point about the Voting Rights Act that fits with what I have believed as well. And he said it ought to be strengthened by making sure that these preclearance provisions that require any proposed laws on elections be precleared by the Justice Department apply to all 50 states and the district, and not just to that narrow band of mostly southern states and areas that had a history of racial discrimination. And I think that would be a very positive thing. It would have a real impact, not enough in voting rights, but maybe we can get that up and let the Republicans filibuster that and then see if we can change Manchin's mind about the need for making some adjustments in the rules.
One thing I really want to ask about is, where is Kamala Harris? I wonder whether President Biden is making the best use of her that he could in these times. We're not seeing her at all.
You know, I'm comfortable with that. She's been given a lot of major responsibilities, and I worry a little bit about that. You know, he put her in charge of the issues at the border, which is fine. And actually, one of the great successes that we've seen is that they've managed to cut back dramatically on the overload of kids separated from their families there. And now the 72-hour rule, where if they come in, they're supposed to be united with a family member or, reunited in some fashion within that 72-hour period, we have them all in that category. But that's a big responsibility, and she has many other responsibilities, and she's doing as Joe Biden did, acting as a counsel to the president, the last one in the room when decisions are made. She doesn't need to be that highly visible figure right now. And in some ways, politically, I think it's better. She is active and dealing with policy issues. She's certainly spending some time in the Senate right now, but the face of the administration should be Joe Biden. The Joe Biden who is a mature, comforting, calming individual, and not somebody who anybody can make a lightning rod. And that's fine. It's not like she's been sidelined. It's not as if she is playing the kind of role that, say, Lyndon Johnson did when John Kennedy was president, minimized and humiliated. She is clearly an integral part of the administration. And so that I'm not concerned about that.
Okay.
My concern at this point, Diane, is making sure that those 50 Democrats in the Senate act in unison and understand the stakes that we're dealing with here. And, you know, we know that Mitch McConnell, candid yet again, as he was when he said that his number one goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president, said that he was entirely focused on blocking anything that Joe Biden and the Biden administration wanted to do. Now, you know, I get continually frustrated by media reports about Democrats are avoiding bipartisanship. It's a two-way street. And when I've seen these efforts by the Republicans now on infrastructure, coming up with what seems to be a reasonable, if a modest package, but one that could easily be, you know, horse-traded into a decent infrastructure package. But then McConnell says, as they all do, it's got to be paid for, but our red line is you cannot touch the 2017 tax cuts. What that says to me is we're not serious about cutting a deal here. And so he's got to make sure that he's got 50 Democrats who say, as Manchin will make every effort to cut a deal. But if we don't, we're going to have to do it on our own through reconciliation, as they did the first time around. And then you've got to be able to change the rules to get some voting rights election protection package done.
So does that mean you've got to use the filibuster or get rid of it?
Well, they're not going to get rid of it. That's a bottom line. There will not be 50 votes to move every legislative item to a 51 vote threshold. But there is ample opportunity with ample options to alter the filibuster. So what I've been proposing for more than a decade in an attempt to find a majority support for it is to put the burden back on the minority where it belongs. Right now, it's all on the majority. And so the proposal is that you flip the numbers from 60 required to end debate to 41 required to continue debate, and make it so that they have to be on the floor, and make it so that they, in fact, if they don't come up with the 41 at any time, you move past that and move to a vote. You can go around the clock. You can make them vote at 4 a.m. You can have sessions on Mondays and Fridays and make it difficult and inconvenient. But you also put a public spotlight on these issues. I'll give you one example of a different sort. The House has passed 2 bills for universal background checks on guns, even as every single day we see more people die, sometimes by suicide, sometimes in mass shootings. And 94% of Americans in surveys support universal background checks. So imagine if they have to come up with 41 votes over and over again to say, no, we're with the 6% and the NRA, and we don't want universal background checks. Right now, what happens is those 2 bills pass the House, they go to the Senate. They're not going anywhere because we know that they could be filibustered. Democrats aren't going to bring them up because it's useless to spend time on it, and nobody will even know that they've died. Now, what I would do, frankly, if I were Chuck Schumer, is instead of bringing those bills up right now, I'd bring up the Manchin-Toomey gun bill. Pat Toomey, very conservative Republican, Joe Manchin, both of whom got A's from the NRA in the past, put together a compromise after Sandy Hook, filibustered and died in the Senate then. Bring it up now, because Joe Manchin says that the filibuster rule encourages bipartisanship. Show that it doesn't. Bring up that John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Make it so that the preclearance applies to everybody. You've got to go through the Justice Department, whether you're in Iowa or Oklahoma or Florida or Pennsylvania, wherever it may be, and show that Republicans, and remember, there are Republicans like Chuck Grassley who co-sponsored the last version of the Voting Rights Act that was blown up by the Shelby County decision. Make them explain why they were for it then and are against it now. And you could make a difference, and maybe you'll get that rules change. But that's a key now. And there's a burden that is as much on Chuck Schumer as it is on Joe Biden to be able to make those things happen.
All right. One last question. Given the divisions that you've already talked about in this climate, with Mitch McConnell saying we're going nowhere with this new proposal that the president has put forward on infrastructure, how likely is he to get that passed?
I think we're going to see a significant infrastructure bill passed. And, you know, it was very interesting to see that in Tennessee, they had to shut down a major freeway because of cracks in the bridges that they're unsafe now. We know how deep the infrastructure needs are. And if you bring up an infrastructure bill that is paid for, and of course, you know, the Republican proposal said it needs to be paid for, but we're not going to give you the specifics here. If they decide that they're going to vote against something that would repair these bridges, that would bring a lot of jobs and money and needed action in their own states because they've raised the corporate rate back up by half of what had been cut by and raised the individual rate to where it was when Ronald Reagan was president. If they want to oppose that, then I think you're going to get a Joe Manchin saying, okay, we have to do this by reconciliation, and they'll get the 50 votes.
Norm Ornstein, as always, thank you.
It's always a pleasure, Diane.
That was Norman Ornstein. He is an emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverka Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.